We'll talk about the economy, saving for a college education, buying a mattress, and have some follow-up to last month's series on home ownership during this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Plus, we will welcome, as always, your personal finance questions for financial planner Kevin McKinley at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. He joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
Have you finished shoveling yet?
Just doing the front side of the driveway right now. I'm going to get to the sidewalks in a little later, and hopefully by Memorial Day I should have the place cleared out.
There we go. Yeah, I was wondering, Kevin, before we get to our special topic today, should we be cracking open the champagne bottles because the Dow broke 15,000 last week and is flirting with it again, you know, these days?
Yeah, it depends. I tend to look at these things less as a celebration or more as a reason for worry, because the higher stock prices are in general, the more likely it is that they are to go down. And part of my job, and now in my DNA and my fiber, is such that I have to worry about this on behalf of other people. And so I tend to worry more when stocks hit highs rather than get excited about it. But I did like the notion that one trader on the floor, they still have those, by the way, real people at the New York Stock Exchange. He had a hat on that said Dow 15,000 on it, and it reminded me of several years ago. The Dow had crossed 10,000 several times, and each time this one guy had put his Dow 10,000 hat on that he'd saved from the first time it hit it. So keep in mind, there's a chance that he may have an opportunity to wear that Dow 10,000 hat once again.
And this is related to our special topic today. You say that recent events may shed light on the economic benefit of government spending. How do you figure that?
Well, and we've heard a lot about that, especially leading up to the election, with talk about cutting spending versus increasing government spending. And then with the sequester and the after effects of that and how much they're going to hurt versus their help. A lot of the discussion over government spending is obviously political, but if you can separate the politics from it, there is a question about the efficiency of it, the value of the government spending versus cutting taxes or just paying off debt or not taking on any more debt. And the word that has really been bandied about in the last 6 months or so is austerity, meaning starting to cut back, spend less, and maybe have more, but definitely draw back the government's position from spending. Lately, though, there's been some news that both in theory and in practice, the government cutting spending can hurt the economy.
What do you mean by in theory?
In 2010, there was a paper that was published by two Harvard professors called Reinhardt Rogoff, and they basically said, we've studied the past economies all over the world, and we found that if government debt exceeds 90% of the country's GDP, gross domestic product, bad things ensue. And that was something that was used for a lot of people who were arguing for austerity and said, we really believe that bad things will happen if the government not only doesn't increase spending but cuts it. We should definitely have them cut spending right now. Well, a grad student from the UMass Amherst found not only a math error from an Excel calculation in the paper's calculations, but also found other errors in it as well. And the paper itself had been discredited. And a lot of people who were championing government spending used this error and the discredit of the paper as a reason to say, see, austerity is not a good thing, and therefore we should keep going. Now, those people still may be right, but the basis on which a lot of the arguments were being made so far has been thrown out the window.
Yeah. You know, coincidentally, Kevin, we talked with the editor of the Capital Times, the associate editor of the Capital Times, John Nichols, in our last hour, and we were talking about austerity, and one of the things we talked about is that a number of other countries in Europe are questioning their austerity measures, saying, hey, we're not sure this is working.
Right. And as he probably mentioned, some of that is due to them being part of the euro, where they're saying, look, the healthier countries in the European community, the ECU, are saying to the less healthy ones, saying, look, we can't keep supporting you if you're going to keep spending money, so you have to cut back. And what they found, of course, is as they've cut back, the economies, for the time being anyway, have actually gotten worse. And the United States has not really had any measurable mark of austerity. If anything, they're spending lots of money. And, you know, causation and correlation is always a problem here. But so far, the United States economy is doing not well, but doing much better than most other large countries' economies, and a lot of money is flowing to the U.S. in the form of investments. And finally, as you probably heard, other countries are reversing course. For instance, yesterday, the finance minister from France said, austerity is over. We're still taking this very seriously, but we're done with this austerity program.
Yeah. So what's your take on the subject, Kevin?
Well, people, general people anyway, the populace, often looks upon the United States or any government's financial situation as a household and get concerned about taking more debt on. And they know that if they take more debt on for no reason, that it can cause bigger problems down the road when they can't pay the debt off. And a more accurate analogy when it comes to the United States is that the country is really more like a business, and government spending is like spending on advertising and marketing. And it can be really wasteful. It can be ineffective. It can be efficient. It can be corrupt. It can be all the things that a company, and if you've seen a private company or any organization spend money on advertising, you know, sometimes it just doesn't work. But without any advertising, sales to the company go down, leaving less money to spend not only on marketing and advertising in the future, but everything else. So with interest rates at all-time lows, demand to lend the money to the United States is at all-time highs for the time being. It is probably the best course of action for the government to keep spending. Again, this could end very badly, but I don't see what other course they can take, and it's just not politically popular to take some short-term pain now versus trying to kick the can down the road and see if the problems can't solve themselves.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services that we discuss are suitable for every investor. Investors should consult with their own financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a question for Kevin about a personal finance matter, 1-800-642-1234. We have an open line for you. 1-800-642-1234. You can also send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. So it's time now for the On Your Money email bag, and this is a follow-up to our series on home ownership over the past month. A listener named Harold said that he sold homes for 20 years and was offering some additional advice and confirmation on some of the things that we discussed during that series. Kevin, what did Harold want to add?
Agrees and verifies something that I've said, he or she gets as much airtime as he or she wants. So we'll definitely bring him in. Harold definitely said to get an appraisal, always get an appraisal along with two market analyses, and then photocopy at least the bottom page of the appraisal and put it on the table along with your marketing brochure. So, and if you have a realtor list the home, do that as well. It's much easier when it comes to pricing the home to say, look, here's an independent analysis. This is what the place is worth. If you want to sell it quickly, price it accordingly. People typically find one or two things wrong with every home, but if they find three or more, then they're going to want a much lower price than what you might think your place is worth. But it's better to sell it quickly and maybe leave a little money on the table than let the house languish on the market. He said you should definitely interview agents and hire one who is experienced and devotes as much time as he or she can to the process of listing and selling your home. And he said definitely keep in touch. Regular communication is very important for both parties.
Thank you very much, Harold. A lot of feedback on the series, Kevin. A lot of participation, too, during that whole month-long series. But we did have another retired realtor who had an opinion that was contrary to yours. What did he say?
Well, he did, first of all, agree with pushing yourself a little when you're buying a home so that, you know, you're getting in the place and hopefully you won't have to move every time you add to the family or things change a little bit. It's easier to stay in the house than it is to move, obviously. He was not a fan of setting up the bidding and the auctions that one of the callers suggested. He said it can leave some hurt feelings with both the people who win the auction and lose the auction. He did say, though, that one person called in and he heard the person say, I'm going to be in grad school and for 5 or 6 years, I'd like to buy a home now so that I can hopefully make some money on it and own my home over the next 5 or 6 years, and then I might be moving. Is that a good idea? I said no. He said yes, because even if the home prices increase, say, 3% on average, plus the tax breaks on the mortgage interest, that he'll more than come out ahead after 5 or 6 years.
So did he change your mind on that?
No. He makes a good point, and as long as home prices do increase 3% every single year, that may be the case. But prices are just as likely to fall as they are to rise, and if there's a significant rise, it can wipe out the equity that the caller had established in his purchased home, and it doesn't take very much to do that. And plus all the expenses of upkeep, property taxes, etc. If it's a very short window, usually 10 years or less, it's very difficult to look upon a home as a money-making investment. You should look on it as a place to live first, and if you happen to make a profit on it, if and when you do sell it, be pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, that really was a good series, Kevin. That was a good idea to focus on that throughout the month. We certainly will accept calls when it comes to home ownership or buying or selling a home if listeners have questions along those lines. You also are thinking of maybe doing another series maybe on cars coming up?
Yeah, I think public radio could use a show where a couple people kind of talk lightly about cars, joke a little bit, hopefully offer some advice. I think it might be big. I don't know. It's just a hunch.
Well, we will probably do that in the future. If you have a question about cars or homes or personal finances of any sorts, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Money is on our mind. This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner. And you are invited to call in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Coming up a little bit later in the program, we will have some advice for you if you're saving for your child's college education, and also some tips on buying a new mattress. To your phone calls now, though, for Kevin McKinley, Tom in Baraboo is first. Hi, Tom.
Good morning.
Morning.
Say, I'm going to be retiring in about a year and a half, and our company now offers a lump sum buyout, and I was just wondering if lump sum buyouts are a pretty good deal or if you invest in the long-range thing and live off some of it. Just batting that idea around. I was wondering if Kevin's got any.
Yeah. So what exactly is a lump sum buyout, Kevin?
Well, Tom, I'm guessing that your choices are where it's your company pension, and they're either saying to you, hey, Tom, here's a big chunk of money, or you can take another option where we'll send you a much smaller check every single month for a period of time. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. On paper, and if everything goes okay, the second option is the better one because you will probably live long enough to get more money from the pension than you will from just taking the lump sum and investing it yourself. The problem is this is not on paper. This is real life. And with any kind of pension or obligation that a company has to pay for a retiree's living expenses, it's going to be very difficult for them to use the internal rates of return that they're saying that they've made their projections on. They might be saying, hey, we think we're going to make 6% a year, and therefore we can pay you this amount of money. And even if they do that, you don't know where the money is invested. You don't have any access to it. And their goals may be completely different from what yours are. They're trying to manage, you know, maybe millions or billions of dollars within this pension, and they're trying to do it so the company doesn't have to add a bunch more money into it to help keep it up. And I do think that down the road, especially when it comes to private companies, a lot of them will, and it's happened already and it is happening, will actually declare bankruptcy so that they can get out of their pension obligations. And on one hand, that's terrible for a retiree. On the other hand, you can't blame them because let's say they're saying, well, we can either pay for these 80-year-olds' monthly expenses like we promised them, or we can keep the business going and we can market and make profits for the shareholders and hire more people, et cetera. So I get why they have to make that choice. I don't like it that they have to choose it. I don't like the choice that they make, but I understand why they do it. So if it were my preference, I'd have you roll the lump sum over into a self-directed IRA account. You can keep it really safe by moving it to a bank or credit union. You can take it to a no-load brokerage like a Vanguard or Charles Schwab or Fidelity or someplace like that, or you'll find plenty of people who will be more than willing to help you invest it for a fee. But at least that way you get total control over it. You know exactly where it is and you can do whatever you want with it, whenever you want with it, and you don't have to worry about what the pension managers might be doing with it 5 or 10 or 20 years down the road.
Makes sense, Tom? Okay. Thanks very much for the call. Well, we have another Tom, this one in Oshkosh. Hello, Tom number two.
Yes, good morning. We're snowbirds back from Arizona, and when we were out, and we also have some CDs coming due that we really count on for income, and they're about to, you know, drop to whatever, 1%, 1.5%. They're offering 3 up to 6% at some institutions in Arizona, FDIC insured. Why should I be careful about that, or what kind of institutions could offer more than what we are offering here in the Midwest?
I'm sorry, Tom. Tell me the rate again that they're offering.
Oh, anywhere from 3 to 3.35. I have another one here that says as high as 6.5 yield and 3.39. I've got four different institutions in front of me here so that from advertising that we clipped out of the paper.
Okay. If you go to bankrate.com, which is a pretty good place to look for CDs, you'll find that those rates are way out of whack with the rest of the country. And there must be something in there that either they're not CDs or this is a teaser rate where they give you the rate for 90 days and then it goes back down to the regular market rates and they have substantial penalties for early withdrawal, even more so than a standard CD. Or it's on the I've seen this offered at some other institutions where they say, hey, we'll pay you 10% on your checking account. Of course, it's just on the first $250, and then it's none percent after that. Well, you can tell then that there, you know, that's $25 a year that they're willing to absorb, if you will. So I would be very leery of those offers. They may be something that is along the lines that might be good for you personally, but no, there's no way that a bank can offer standard CD rates at anything. I think about the highest I've seen recently is closer to 2% rather than 3 to 6%.
Mm-hmm. If it's too good to be true, it's
yes, sir.
It is.
Yeah. All those sneakers. All right, Tom, thanks very much for the call. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley, and this is On Your Money. Our next caller is Kim in Milwaukee. Hello, Kim.
Hi. I wanted to ask about buying a car. Yeah, I've been sort of running I'm 25 years old. I inherited my mother's old car, and I've been sort of running it into the ground, and it's not going to last much longer. So I have to think about in the next year or so buying either a new car or a used car. Does he have advice about that? Mm-hmm. And, like, how to buy a used car and what to look for.
Let's start that series right now, Kevin.
What?
That was your click and clack impression.
Sorry,
okay.
Thank you very much. Yes, Kim, great question, and it's an eternal question, especially with people who are sensible about their money, because typically buying a used car seems to be the smarter thing to do. It's less expensive. You've already had a lot of depreciation in the vehicle that you don't have to pay for. Let me ask you this. Are you in a situation where you rely on your vehicle heavily to get to and from work?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you have pretty good credit?
I have pretty good credit.
Okay. Do you have a ton of cash sitting around?
No.
Okay. all of those answers, Kim, first of all, are extremely common. Second of all, it leads me to say that you're actually better off buying a new car. And here's why. And this is less so now than it was a couple years ago. But due to several factors, one is the Cash for Clunkers program. The other one is the downturn in the economy. Demand for used cars went up versus supply, and demand for new cars went down versus supply. And consequently, up till very recently, it was actually a better deal to buy a new car for what you get for what you pay. That's changed in part because things have gotten better in the economy and it's evening out a little better. But when you buy a new car, here are the advantages of it. First of all, you get a set of problems with the car that are less likely to occur because it's new. And if they do occur, they're more likely to be covered by the manufacturer's warranty. The second thing you get is, and I think you should get a loan for it if you have good credit, is you get a longer loan term that you can pay off whenever you want, generally with no penalty, and a lower interest rate. And the third thing you get is predictable, reliable transportation. Even if you were to buy a used car and save some money, the minute something goes wrong with that, you got to figure out getting the car to the repair facility. You have to figure out getting to and from work, getting back to picking it up, whatever, and paying a little bit extra per month for the loan payment for this new car, in my mind anyway, is worth it. It's almost like insurance for saying that you're much less likely to have problems that are going to disrupt your day, making it more difficult to get to work. A website you want to go to check prices on new cars is TrueCar.com, T-R-U-E-C-A-R, TrueCar.com. It's a great way to check prices and see what the dealer can offer and shop around without having to go from lot to lot to lot to lot. And we'll put a link up to TrueCar.com at our website, OnYourMoney.com, later on today.
Thank you.
All right, Kim, thanks very much. Good luck to you. It's an exciting time. Kevin, what about the argument that let somebody else pay for the depreciation of a new car? I mean, that's not the case anymore?
Well, it is, and I still agree with that to a lesser extent, but the depreciation is the biggest cost of actually owning the car. Cars typically drop about 10 to 20% in value every single year. So if you have a $30,000 car, the depreciation can cost you anywhere from $3,000 to $6,000 in the first year that you own it. But the years tend to go by pretty quickly, and I know On Your Money listeners and Wisconsin Public Radio listeners well enough to know that they tend to drive cars for a very long time, and therefore the depreciation isn't as big of a deal than it would be if people were to trade cars every single year or two.
Yeah. Well, the update on my husband's car, he brought it in. He thought it was going to cost a fortune to fix it. We thought maybe this was going to be the time we had to bite the bullet and replace the vehicle. Everything is fine on this 2000 CRV, and we're going to keep driving that thing until we drive it into the ground, because that's what we do. We're public radio listeners.
it's in your DNA, isn't
yes.
it?
Sharon in Appleton is with us. Hello, Sharon.
Hi. Well, first of all, I want to say that I actually do really love this show. To the point where if I miss it, I will go on the WPR archive.
Oh, great.
I've even taken notes, so that I'm almost pathetic. But
that's great.
Regardless, I think this is a great show. Having said that, my question is, my husband and I are both in our early 50s. We've worked hard to save, and we have right now most of our money is in the stock market. And because I don't feel 100% confident about that, we are considering looking at buying a vacation rental to rent out. And as I've been looking, especially on the West Coast and the East Coast, I've noticed that some of the markets for those homes in about 2004 to 2006 fell about 30%. And it looks, when I look at occupancy for some of these places, they really look quite good. And so I wondered if you had any, and I should also say there's a lot of foreclosures because of that fall. And I wondered if you had any thoughts on doing something like that.
Yeah, first of all, Sharon, thank you for your kind words, but we cannot take your call. We only accept false praise, and yours sound real.
That was genuine, yeah.
Yeah, it sounds genuine. So have a good day. Thank you. Good luck. Yeah, and I don't think this is too crazy, and you sound like you've met my first criteria for this kind of venture, which you've done some homework on it. And you know, the house prices can continue to fall on these vacation rentals. So can just about every other investment out there, unless you've got it in a, you know, buried in the hole in the ground or in a short-term CD or treasury bond. So and the house prices are lower compared to what they've been, and the stock market in general is higher. So common sense maybe not be accurate, but it would say that the prices on stocks are closer to the high than they are the low, and the prices on some of this real estate is probably closer to the low than it is the high. Here's what I'd have you do. I don't mind you doing this. As long as you understand that this is a can be a good way to get rich slowly, meaning that the likelihood that these prices are going to rapidly appreciate for the next 5 to 10 years in this kind of property are very small. However, they can appreciate, and the cash flow can offset the cost of it, if you will. Here's what I'd prefer you do just offhand. I would have you say, okay, let's say we have X amount of dollars in the stock market, and we're thinking about using some of that to buy the property. I would instead get a loan to purchase the property if it's possible and if the terms are easy to deal with, and then pull an equivalent of money out of the stock market and put it in a very safe place, like your checking account, CDs, savings bonds, whatever, knowing full well that you can bleed that money off to cover payments on the loan if you need to keep the game going. Or you can, if you get tired of it, you say, you know what, I don't like having the debt and I don't like having the money, this liquid money, we don't need it. I'm just going to cash in this safe money and pay the loan off. It gives you a lot more flexibility in the future than if you just pull it out of the stock market, pay whatever capital gains you're going to pay, and then use cash to purchase it. Now, the cash does give you some advantages over other buyers, but I'd first of all see just what kind of loan terms you could get, and then because you've been so nice, you can even check back with us after you get those numbers, and we'll follow up and tell you what to do then.
Okay, and so we were actually thinking of just maybe doing the 20%, so we wouldn't have to pay the PMI, and then financing the rest. But so you're saying just take an equivalent amount, put it in something safe, so we're covered.
Yeah, that seems like a safer way to go. And then if you're right and the stock market is high, you've pulled some profits off of the table at this point, and you've got the money there which can help offset any shortage of cash flow that you have. But no, I think it actually can be a very healthy diversification as long as you understand you're not going to get rich on it quickly, but you can build up some equity in it over the long term. Definitely you want to look at a property management company, too, to run the thing for you when you're not around.
Okay, well, I have to thank you because based on your answer a few calls ago, we may have made a bad decision because we were one of those people who took the traditional pension with the big company and didn't take that one-time offer that they give you for. So maybe this will make up for that bad mistake. But
I hope it's the worst financial mistake you ever make. It's not the end of the world.
Yeah. Sharon, thank you so much for the call. Good luck to you, and you are not pathetic. You're wonderful. She said, I'm so pathetic. John in Waukesha. Hi, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is about rental properties. I bought a couple rental properties in Florida over the last 2 years. I do plan to move down to one of them in about 8 to 10 years, but I'm wondering if you could recommend any particular resources to make sure that I'm getting the most out of those rental properties in terms of tax returns and deductions and depreciation, et cetera.
Yeah. Do you have a CPA, John?
No, I don't have a CPA.
Okay. I would get a CPA, and I would find one who is you're going to need two different CPAs, probably one at first who is because you're a Wisconsin resident, who can tell you what deductions you can get for being a Wisconsin resident. Then if you move to Florida, the different laws affect you differently. And so you'll have to find one down in Wisconsin. We have a link up that we'll put up at onyourmoney.com so that you can search for CPA. But make sure he or she has expertise in rental properties and getting all the breaks that you possibly can. Again, it can be a very nice deal as long as the cash flow covers your expenses. It typically can be a nice way to build up some wealth, offer a little diversification from other kinds of paper investments. But as you probably can tell already, it's not a great way to get rich. It just kind of covers itself until lo and behold, you go, oh, geez, it's been a decade and we've got some value in this.
Thanks for the call, John. Good luck to you. It's time now for Smart Assets, and in our Smart Assets segment, we'll take a question from Sarah, who says, I look forward to hearing you every week on Joy's show. Our household has followed your advice along with others to try to keep our financial wits. Thank you so much for keeping your sense of humor in a serious world. You make me laugh, and that's a great gift. Now, that sounds like genuine praise, too, Kevin.
Yes, it does. And in this world, especially when you're talking about government, politics, finance, money, all that, if you don't laugh, you'll cry.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Sarah goes on to say that she is struggling to figure out how much to pay for her children's college education without saddling each kid with $100,000 in student loans by the time they graduate. She's filled out the free application for the federal student aid. Mm-hmm. She says that she will be looking into scholarship, and she wants to know how other families do it, whether she's missing some sort of tip or trick. What do you think, Kevin?
It sounds like she is suffering from sticker shock, and which is definitely understandable because these kids grow up faster than we could ever hope or imagine they do. And if things work out really well, they are college material. But then you actually look at the price and the cost and realize that most people don't feel like they have just, you know, several hundred thousand dollars just sitting around waiting to hand over to some qualified college or university. But other families, not nearly as smart or as wealthy as Sarah's, have done it. And her family can do it, too, if they follow the secret trick. Paying for $100,000 worth of college expenses is like eating an elephant. It can be done, but you just have to do it one bite at a time.
So, still, walk us through eating this elephant.
Okay, let's take the $100,000, and a bunch of parents of new children are driving their kids to school right now, looking in the back seat, going, all of this, and I get to pay $250,000 for your education, too. But let's take the $100,000, which this is not out of reason, because you're looking at probably about $16,000 in tuition and fees, and maybe another $9,000 in living expenses per year. But they can do this if they have $25,000 in savings, or maybe set aside in their retirement accounts or their home equity. That's not my preferred way to go, but it can be done. And then over the 4 years, they make monthly payments of $500, which equals $25,000, give or take. While the kid is home, that kid is probably spending somewhere between a few hundred to several hundred dollars per month in food expenses that they will no longer be liable for. The kid can kick in $25,000 with earnings by $6,000 a year of work. That's 15 hours a week or just working full-time in the summer. And then finally, it is okay if the kid graduates from college with $25,000 in debt. That's, first of all, about the average. About two-thirds of kids leave school with debt, and $25,000 is about the median amount. But they can pay that amount off by making payments of about $250 per month over 10 years time frame, which, as we've talked about, it's about my cable bill right now. And that can all be done. But one of the things that people should use as sticker shock as kind of a motivator is to really change the way you think or we've thought about college over the last 50 years.
So how should I change the way I think about college?
If it's really an economic decision, first of all, I'd look upon it as a luxury. You know, spending $200,000 on a private education, especially undergraduate, is really a nice thing. It can give great value, but it is a luxury. And so you have to, a lot of people who wouldn't spend $5,000 on a car for their kid are doing everything they can to spend $150,000 to $200,000 on it. And the second thing is look upon this as go one of two ways, either speed it up or slow it down. If you speed it up, have the kid get as many, you know, AP credits while they're in high school or other credits in advance of actually going to college. Once the kid is in college, have her go year-round, take classes during the winter, take as many classes as she can during the summer break. I'd rather have college kids in this situation not work. I'd rather have them borrow and take more credits instead while they're in school. And the key to saving money on this is if you can get out in a shorter period of time, like 3 to 3.5 years, you're going to not only save a lot of money on living expenses over the time that you would have paid while you were still in school, but you also get into the workforce and hopefully start making more money. And that difference between not having living expenses and then having income can mean 20 to 30% savings of the overall cost.
So how or why would you slow down the college degree process?
And just do it gradually. Take a 6 to 7 year plan for it. You know, take some credits at a local community college or a nearby state school so that you can commute and live at home with your parents. It sounds terrible, but again, I hope this is the worst thing that ever happens to you. You can go part-time, take maybe 8 to 10 10 credits and then work part-time to help pay for your living expenses and the credits. And keep in mind that when you tell an 18-year-old what's going to take you 6 to 7 years to get out of school, they might roll their eyes. But most people do not graduate in 4 years. Typically, of all the people who are starting at college for the first time in the freshman year this fall, only about a quarter to a third of them at most will have a degree by the time 4 years rolls around. So you'll be in the majority, and just like the cool kids, if you do take your time getting all the way through school.
So what about parents who have a child who wants to attend an expensive school, and they're having a hard time saying no to that child?
Well, it's still okay to try to figure out help. Fill out that FAFSA, as we mentioned, and try to get whatever financial aid you can. A lot of times, really expensive private schools also have generous financial packages, which can help mitigate the cost quite a bit. But another way to do it is cap the amount that you're willing to contribute to the kid's education and then tell him or her that the rest is going to be up to you. For instance, you might say, hey, you know what, this is going to cost $200,000 over 4 years. We will pay $50,000 of that, which should get you in pretty good shape at a state school. But the other $150,000, if it means that much to you, then you're going to have to come up with that yourself. And then if the parents can afford to and want to, once the kid graduates, they can help the kid pay off the debt if they have to come up with it. And finally, you don't want to use this right away, but you can use what I call the doomsday solution, which says to the kid, look, we can pay $200,000 for your education at this school no one has ever heard of and doesn't seem to offer any value. But if we do that, we won't be able to retire on our own, and we'll have to eventually come and live with you.
There we go. Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. We will come back with some advice on mattress shopping. We're going to go shopping for mattresses coming up on Your Money. And two more of your questions. If you have a personal finance question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org.
You better shop around.
You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. And it's time to shop around for mattresses. If you can't remember how long ago you bought your most recent mattress, you're not alone. And Kevin, why do you say now is the time we should consider buying a new one?
Well, in the next few weeks or so, mattresses should be on sale even more so than they usually are. And in a previous life, Joy, I spent from the age of 14 through the age of about 22, selling mattresses for my father's. It was called the Happy Sleeper Stores. I bet many people still are around the place, but you recognize that. I did it in Eau Claire and Madison, and it was a great experience for me because I, as a person in my mid-teens, I got to sit and watch complete strangers lie down on beds and stare at each other while I kind of uncomfortably shifted my feet and tried to look in the other direction. But
yeah,
I enjoyed it. I learned a lot about it. But Memorial Day is typically a good time to buy a mattress in Box Spring. And a lot of people who haven't thought about this in a long time should, because even if you keep a mattress in Box Spring for 10 years, which is longer than you probably should, and even if you spend $2,000 for it, which is more than you probably should, that only works out to about 60 cents per day, or about a dime an hour or less of the amount of sleep that you're probably getting from it. And a good night's sleep can lead to better health, more productivity, and better happiness. So investing a little bit in a mattress can be one of the best moves you could make.
Boy, I'm embarrassed to say I don't think we've replaced our mattress in well over 10 years.
Well, you and Rob still have the bunk beds? Or
yes, the water bed.
The race car, right?
So where should we start?
At your local store, I would suggest, because that's the best place to try the beds out. You're going to run into three different kinds of mattresses. One is the innerspring, which we're used to. One is the Air, the Selecta Comfort customized air pockets. And then the final one, and this is becoming much more popular, is some kind of foam or memory foam. And they all have their advantages and their disadvantages depending on what you're looking for.
All right. Well, what are the advantages to each of them?
The Innerspring one is going to be the least expensive, and because they're adding a lot more padding on top of them, it's probably a little softer than the one you have, or the padding is new and it's not worn down like the one is on your current Innerspring mattress. The air beds do offer the customization, so if you have a little bit of a difference in opinion from your sleep partner, you can adjust that accordingly. And then finally, the foam can offer more of a consistent surface, and so when you're moving around or whatever, the foam is generally less likely to have different pressure points on your body, and especially as we get older, it can make a big difference. So the foam's likely to be a little smoother and firm where you want it to be and softer where you want it to be.
Okay, the downsides for each of them then?
Well, with all of these, you're probably going to have to buy new sheets because with all these extra paddings that they put on top, your fitted sheets aren't going to be big enough to cover them. An Innerspring mattress is going to be more uneven. And again, if you do have a partner and they're moving around a lot, they're more likely to wake you up. The air beds are expensive, and there's some question about the durability. You know, I was selling mattresses and beds at the heyday of the waterbed area, and it's a little more durable, these air beds are, but they're still, they don't last quite as long, and there can be more potential mechanical malfunction with them. And then with the foam, I have a foam bed. I think it's really great, but the memory foam especially can get very high. So if you tend to be a warm sleeper, be on the lookout for that because the foam tends to retain body heat even more, and it become your own personal sauna every night.
Any other secrets or shopping tips that we ought to keep in mind?
Well, I definitely recommend going to local stores, but also shop around. A lot of big box stores carry beds now like Sam's and Costco, and the prices are quite a bit lower. The service isn't there, obviously, but you will pay less. And you can also go online. Amazon actually has several different foam mattresses that they sell through different resellers that are actually compressed down that you open up that have some good reviews. You do want to negotiate because there's a lot of profit margin in these a lot of times. But the two most important things to know before you buy a mattress is the trial period. Is there one? How long does it last? And what are the cost and rules regarding the trial period, because you do need to sleep on this thing for at least a few weeks before you can decide if it's right for you. And then also the warranty. Get all of this in writing and make sure that it's signed off and you understand it completely. And then finally, see if you are buying one, make sure that if they're going to deliver it, you can also get them to haul away the old mattress, because that can be a pain and very expensive as well.
Yeah, good idea. You know, I never even thought of that. You can say, hey, give me a few weeks to sleep on this thing, and then you can return it if you're not getting a good night's sleep.
And that's part of the second question is, mm-hmm, when you are buying one, make sure and say, is this a new one or has someone else tried this out for 2 or 3 weeks?
Oh.
And am I paying for someone else's unfortunate experience?
So is there one of these three basic types of mattresses that would be best for your dog and your cat?
they seek their own sleeping space, and there's really not a lot you can do about
it. That's right. So if you have a question now for Kevin, but you didn't know that he used to be a mattress salesman, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And our next caller is Barant in Madison. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, we are thinking of selling our home, and we're trying to find the right market value for the home. So last time you mentioned about getting an appraiser. So I did some internet search, and there's another site called Zillow, and there's a city's assessment as well. So what is the advantage of going through the property assessor versus the city's tax assessment and other websites like Zillow?
That's a great question, Barat, and I am glad you're using an appraiser. It's a good idea for both buyers and sellers of a prospective property. The assessor is really the person who decides what your house is worth relative to others in the particular geographic area, so that property taxes can be assessed. And it can be a helpful tool in figuring a house's value, but the appraiser's opinion matters a lot more, because the appraisers generally, that's what banks use when they tell people how much they can, you know, borrow for a particular home for the purchase price for it. And so I would much rather have you use an appraiser rather than an assessor. That opinion is more important. And if you go to appraisers.org, or you can go to onyourmoney.com, and we discussed that link last week, and so we still have it up there as well. But go to appraisers.org, and then you can search for one in your area.
Good luck, Barat. Chet in Green Bay is with us now. Hello, Chet.
Good morning. How are you today?
Very well.
The reason for my call is last night my wife and I were socializing with some young friends, and the urban myth came up, well, if you have over $3 million, that is all going to be taxed heavily now, not as an estate, but as current value, to pay for Obamacare, so on and so forth. Now, obviously, this is not true, but why do people believe in these urban myths that they get off of Facebook and from their brother-in-law, number one? And number two, I teach graduate-level econ at the university, so I'm sick of these questions. And number three, where can I send these people to a site that debunks these myths?
Chat. I share your outrage, and I don't even mind. You know, I'm fairly apolitical when it comes to matters of finance, but I agree with you. I always seem to get these from the same people, and it's the downside of the technological advances is that people can send these things out quickly for free, and they send it. First of all, you're right. The $3 million thing is a canard right now. It's something we're going to address down the road, but it's not like the money's going to be confiscated. And as it does relate to, it's going to be confiscated as taxes, but it always will be anyway. Even if you have $3,000 or $3 billion in your IRA, eventually you or someone you love is going to pay taxes on that money. It's just a question of when. Now, and also what I would do is I'd actually go to Snopes.com, S-N-O-P-E-S.com, and they typically have a good ear to the ground about a lot of these different emails and get these things forwarded to them. And so then they check them out and try to do it. And also factcheck.org as well is a good place to go. They tend to go to grab different political things that are being run off the flag from all different sides and figure out what the actual truth is behind it.
All right, Chet. Thanks for the call. Lauren in Eau Claire is with us. Hello, Lauren.
Hello. I've got a question about another question about car buying. The caller earlier, you recommended purchasing a new car. I am wondering in what situations you would recommend purchasing a used car. The primary use for this vehicle would be my husband's going into work. He works about 3 miles from home each way, so about 6 miles a day, and then a trip vehicle. And we do have cash for a fairly decent down payment. So wondering in what situations you would recommend purchasing a used car instead of
sure.
a new car.
The used car is in your situation would probably be a better deal, and especially for one that does have high miles on it now because you're going to pay less for it, but you're going to add a commensurate lower amount of miles to that over the time that you use it. I would definitely go with a used car in this situation. Still get a loan for it and still get it for 4 years, and keep in mind that you can always pay it off early if the cash doesn't have a better place to go, but it's nice to have the loan out there when you can get it and have it and not need it rather than need it and not have it. So I would rather have you do that. And make sure you check on that car, and we'll be talking about this again, Lauren, but with a lot of the natural disasters we've had in the States, a lot of cars have been flooded or been affected by this. So, you know, use one of those car check or one of those services to look up the VIN number of the vehicle and see if it ever has gone through some kind of flood situation. Actually, when we cover this in a few weeks, there's a website up that you can check it to see if the vehicle has been flood damaged specifically.
Lauren, thank you for the call. Here's an email from Jason. I love your show. I listen to it every chance I get. Sure, Jason. I'm considering starting my own handyman business, but I'm not sure where to start. Please help.
Well, I applaud this because I'm the kind of person, Jason, where we practically hire a guy to come out to the house and change our light bulb. So I think there's a lot of people like me, and as our populace gets older, there are going to be a lot more people like me and just say, like, I don't want to deal with this, or I don't know how. I'd much rather pay someone to do it. The first thing I would do is get all the licenses and insurance that you need for both liability and for entering someone's home. The second thing, I would set up an LLC. A lot of people think that they need to set up an LLC because they are doing this for tax reasons. And it is for tax reasons, but it's more for limited liability, meaning if you're doing something that damages the person's home, more so than what you have in personal assets, you want to have the LLC set up to at least shield your personal assets, and then hopefully the insurance will pay for it. Get a good tax person, but I'll tell you what, if you know what you're doing, at least in the circles in which I move, you will have more work than you can possibly stand.
Thank you, Jason. Call your business on your house or something like that, and we'll be sure to check you out. All right, so what's the website of the week, Kevin?
Well, there's a website called collegemeasures.org, which is measuring different schools with metrics about different colleges, mostly public schools, with metrics like the salary, the student loan default rate, the amount of time it takes for the kids to get through the school, et cetera. Collegemeasures.org, and we'll have that website up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Sounds great. Time for four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. He will be back again next week with another edition of On Your Money. Thanks to Bill Martins and to Cynthia Schuster and to Robin Cherry for producing this program. Thanks to Rich Kramer for his help in Eau Claire. And thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. And I hope you join us tomorrow at this time. We will talk with a guest physician who has authored the new book, Power Foods for the Brain, what foods we should eat in our diet and which ones to avoid to reduce our risk of Alzheimer's, stroke, and other health conditions. That's tomorrow at this time. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.